On a windy hill near the small southern Illinois town of Equality is a decaying mansion that was known for decades as the region's most haunted house. It was a place dubbed Hickory Hill by its builder, and over the years, it's been many things. A plantation house, a farmhouse, a tourist attraction, and many believe a chamber of horrors for men and women brought to this house in chains. Thanks to the long-standing legend of the terrible things that occurred in the house, locals eventually began referring to it as the Old Slave House. For more than 70 years, travelers from all over the Midwest came to see the mysterious and isolated old house, but time, expenses, controversy, and the eccentricity of its last owner closed its doors in 1996. It's now owned by the state of Illinois, closed to the public and unlikely to ever reopen. And yet the stories of Hickory Hill continue to be told. They still linger behind the locked doors and shuttered windows. And they say the dead of Hickory Hill do not rest in peace. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to our latest season, Home, which is written and performed by Troy Taylor and produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. This is season 8 of the American Hauntings podcast, Home. With this episode and the season ahead, we'll be going in search of America's murder houses, where the spirits of the past still linger. Throughout the year, we'll be taking you behind the locked doors of both famous and little-known places, where murder, violence, and bloody events have occurred that left a mark on the house as a haunting. History and hauntings in every single episode. And in this episode, we'll be visiting a house known for decades as the most infamous and sinister dwelling in southern Illinois, a legendary spot that has a long history of legend, lore, and terrifying truth. Hickory Hill was built by John Hart Crenshaw, a descendant of an old American family with ties to the founding of the nation. In fact, his grandfather, John Hart, was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Crenshaw, described as a good Methodist and a pillar of the community, would earn his own spot in history, but not for anything quite as noble as what his grandfather did. Born in November 1797 along the borders of North and South Carolina, Crenshaw's family moved west and settled along the Missouri side of the Mississippi River, where their farm and home was destroyed by the Great New Madrid earthquake of 1811. The earthquake and subsequent flood forced a move to Saline County, Illinois, where they purchased land. They established a farm and began developing a salt well on the property called Half Moon Lick. Not long after becoming established in southern Illinois, which was not yet a state, Crenshaw's father, William, died and left John, who was the oldest, to provide for his mother and six brothers and sisters. By the time he was 18, he was operating a salt refinery at Half Moon Lick and renting additional land for the processing of more salt. It's hard for us to understand today how much demand there was for salt in the first half of the 19th century. In those days, I mean, salt could be used as money or as barter material when you were purchasing goods or supplies. In those days, before artificial refrigeration, and especially in places where ice was scarce, salt was used to preserve meat and other goods. Those traveling west from the Atlantic states to Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, and beyond, they needed a way to preserve their food supplies while on the trail, and that was what salt came in handy for. Most of the salt mined in the early 19th century came from Virginia, so the discovery of a large salt reservation in the Illinois Territory was big news at the time. The government leased the lands to businessmen and farmers like John Crenshaw, starting in 1812. These individual operators rented tracts of salt land and hired men to work the mines. It was hot, brutal, backbreaking work, and the pay was low, so it was difficult to find men to do it. That meant that, in most cases, black men were hired to work in the pits. Many of them had escaped from slavery in the southern states, limiting them in the job market, but even free black men in Illinois had a hard time finding other work. The mine owners took advantage of this and paid them little for what they did. However, they did construct a small village where the men could work and where they could live, a cluster of shacks and a company store called U.S. Salines. In 1927, the town earned the name Equality, Illinois. In 1829, in an effort to raise money to build a new penitentiary in Alton and to make other improvements in Illinois, the state decided to sell off the salt lands. The various renters were given the opportunity to purchase the holdings they'd been working, and most of them, including John Crenshaw, snapped up the land. Eventually, he owned several thousand acres of salt wells, and by then had also built three salt furnaces to speed up the processing. Crenshaw's purchase of the salt lands was only the next step to his becoming one of the most influential men in the region. In 1817, he'd married Cynthia Taylor and began developing the wide-reaching business interests that built his large fortune. Known for years as the Salt King, he made so much money that at one point he paid 1/7 of all the taxes paid in the state. He used the money he earned to make investments that went beyond salt mines and sawmills. He was also a farmer, a real estate speculator, toll bridge owner, farmer, railroad builder, and director for Illinois' First State Bank in Shawneetown. He was also a supporter of the Methodist Church and a leader in the local Democratic Party. But of course, those aren't the things he's remembered for today. Over the years, his name has been closely tied to kidnapping, slavery, and what historians have called the reverse Underground Railroad. But how is this possible in Illinois, the land of Lincoln, where slavery wasn't even allowed? It's true that Illinois was technically a free state in the 1800s, but it did recognize three kinds of slavery, including indentured servitude, which is sort of a form of slavery by contract that lasted for a specific amount of time. Then when Illinois became a state in 1818, its constitution allowed the ownership of slaves, but only by the original French settlers and their descendants who lived along the Mississippi River. They were the first in the state, and their slaves were protected by a treaty that had been signed in 1783. But the state also allowed slaves to be leased for one-year terms to work in the salt lands of Gallatin, Hardin, and Saline counties. Workers were always needed for the salt mines. They worked the salt wells, cut trees, and hauled wood for the fires that boiled the salt water in cast iron kettles. After boiling, the salt was loaded into wooden barrels, which were also made at the site. A 50-pound bushel of salt was made from as much as 300 gallons of spring water, and a daily yield ran from 80 to 100 bushels every day. The salt was then hauled by oxen to Shawneetown, where it was loaded onto keelboats. The work was brutal and attracted only the most desperate workers. Because of this, as in the cotton fields of the South, slavery became essential to the success of the salt operations. The provision for it allowed salt landowners to lease slaves from Kentucky and Tennessee. In that era, African Americans, slave or free, had little or no protection under the law. Illinois slavery laws were a mess. Initially, it was discouraged, but stopped short of being illegal. The 1819 Illinois Slave Code gave only minimum protection to free blacks. A certificate of freedom and a description of every member of the family had to be on file at the county clerk's office to keep them from being harassed as slaves. The word of a black man could not be used in a court of law, and if a man was deemed lazy or disobedient, he could be publicly whipped by pretty much anyone. White residents could also be fined or whipped if they provided any sort of assistance to a runaway slave or if they brought a slave into Illinois for the purpose of allowing them freedom. Free blacks who lived in Illinois had a few more rights than slaves, but not many. There were also gaps in the law that did nothing to discourage the practice of kidnapping them and selling them into slavery. Only civil prosecution was used to punish this practice, and few officials ever interfered with those who did it. Well, during the 1830s and 40s, especially in the summer months when things were dry and the rivers were easy to cross, many slaves escaped through this area from Kentucky and Tennessee. Once they made it into Illinois, many believed they were safe. only to run into outlaws and thugs, many of whom were on the payroll of John Crenshaw. His riders were posted along the Ohio River at night, hoping to catch fugitives that crossed the state line. The slaves were captured and ransomed back to their masters or were returned for a reward. They also kidnapped free men, women, and children and sold them in the southern slave markets. This was the origin of the reverse underground railroad to which John Crenshaw has been linked. Now, questions remain about how closely Crenshaw was involved in this operation, but only because no written records were kept. We do know that he leased slaves from Kentucky as workers for the salt mines, but it's been said he also kept men in his employ who watched for escaped slaves passing through the area. Under the law, Crenshaw's men could capture runaway slaves and turn them over to a local law office for a reward. If no reward had been offered for the runaway, the county would pay a flat $10 fee. In addition to the fee, Crenshaw could then lease the slave to the county at a lower rate. But it's been alleged that he made more money by pressing them into service on his farm or by selling the slaves directly back into the southern market. As far as anyone knew, Crenshaw was a respected businessman, church-going elder, and a great asset to the community. No one had any idea that he was working illegal slaves in his fields and salt wells, or that he was suspected of kidnapping black families and selling them into slavery. They would have been even more surprised to learn that slaves were held captive in the barred chambers of the third-floor attic at Hickory Hill. It was in those cells that the men were treated with cruelty and the women were raped, because a pregnant slave was worth nearly twice as much as a female with no child. The rapist was said to have also been a slave, one they called Uncle Bob, whose real name was Robert Wilson. He would later claim to have sired no less than 300 children during a decade of imprisonment at Hickory Hill. He later gave many interviews to historians about his time on Crenshaw's farm, and he died at the age of 114 at the Elgin, Illinois Veterans Hospital in 1949. If the stories of what happened in that attic are true, then it must have been a dark and horrific place, which just might explain the chilling tales of the house that have been left behind. John Crenshaw had originally hired an architect to design Hickory Hill in 1833, but thanks to the years that Crenshaw spent trying to get a spur line of the Shawneetown and Alton Railroad built into Equality, he had little time to spend on the project. This caused the house not to be completed until 1842. It towered three stories on the top of that hill and had huge columns cut from the hearts of individual pine trees, spanning the front of the house and supporting the wide verandas. The main entrance door was in the center of the front porch. A second door was located above it, opening onto the second floor balcony. The house was furnished with original artwork and designs that had been imported from Europe. Each of the 13 rooms on the first and second floors were heated with separate fireplaces. The house was certainly grand, even at a time when large, extravagant homes were being built across the region in towns like Cairo and Shawneetown. There was nothing quite like Hickory Hill in southern Illinois, but the most unusual features were hidden from view. Legend has it there was once a tunnel that connected the basement to the Saline River, which offered unseen access both day and night. Another passageway, large enough to contain a wagon, was built into the rear of the house. It allowed vehicles to enter into the house and load or unload anything where it couldn't be seen from outside. The second floor was where the bedrooms were located, designed to catch the breezes on the hilltop, with large windows and French doors, but it was the third floor that held the infamous confines of the attic. For many, this floor offers the proof that Crenshaw had something unusual in mind for Hickory Hill when he had it designed. The attic could only be reached by a flight of narrow wooden stairs. A wide hallway ran down the center of the room. On each side of the corridor was a row of narrow rooms with bars on the doors. They can't be described as anything other than cells. There were flat wooden bunks in each one. Originally, there were no windows on this floor and no ventilation. The large window located there now was added in the 1920s, because the heat in the room was unbearable in the summer. When secured in the cells, slaves could be chained to the floor or to the wall with a metal ring and heavy chain. The slaves were treated cruelly, beaten for any infraction, real or imagined. There were two wooden frames later discovered in the barn on the property that were believed to be whipping posts. When a slave disobeyed orders or failed to complete his work, they could be tied up and flogged. One historical description of the posts stated that they were, quote, built of heavy timber, pegged together. A man of average height could be strung up by his wrists and his toes would barely touch the lower crosspiece. Stories claim that Crenshaw himself often doled out the punishments, and these were not secondhand stories. They came from Crenshaw's own descendants. Family members claim they were forced to watch the slaves being whipped, and the treatment of them went beyond just cruelty to being inhumane. How much of what Crenshaw did when it came to slavery and kidnapping was real, and how much of it is merely Southern Illinois tradition? Well, that's a question that historians have been trying to answer for years. While some deny the stories, or at least parts of them, others point to disturbing clues that seem to point to the fact that Crenshaw was not the pillar of the church and community that he seemed to be. As mentioned, there were no written records of Crenshaw's involvement in illegal or at least immoral activities, but he did have several brushes with the legal authorities. In 1842, for example, he was indicted for the kidnapping of a free black woman named Maria Adams and her children. Shawneetown newspaper accounts report that Crenshaw engineered the removal from their home at night, had them tied in a wagon and shipped them out of state where they were sold into the slave market and never seen again. However, since no one could find Maria or her children, the prosecutor was unable to make the charges stick and the indictment was dismissed. But there were more. In the late 1990s, historians were able to link Crenshaw to at least five other kidnappings involving 12 different people. There was also a report that tied him to the kidnapping of a 10-year-old black boy who was sold for $200. Crenshaw was also accused of some underhanded business dealings around this time in the newspapers. One account publicly declared that one of his nephews had accused him of cheating him out of his father's estate. A civil suit was filed, but was later settled out of court. Then on March 25th, 1842, right around the time that Crenshaw was accused of kidnapping Maria Adams and her family, a sawmill that he owned in Cypressville was burned to the ground. According to the Sangamo Journal newspaper, the burning of the mill happened as a result of the kidnapping accusation. The story read, "The steam mill of Mr. John Crenshaw in Gallatin County was burned. It appears that a short time previous, he sold a family of Negroes on whose services he had claims to a trader, and that these Negroes were shipped to the lower country, probably to be sold into perpetual slavery. By some, it was believed that the mill was burnt by Negroes in revenge for this act." Well, luckily, no one was killed in the blaze, but two of the workers were badly injured. The fire and the accusations and publicity that caused it sent Crenshaw's business into a decline by the middle 1840s. Several new civil court actions were filed against him, and salt deposits discovered in Ohio proved to be more profitable than those in Illinois. Legend also has it that Crenshaw was attacked by one of his slaves around this time. He was allegedly beating a woman in his fields, and a man stepped in to defend her, swinging an axe and wounding Crenshaw's leg so badly it had to be removed. Now, some family members would maintain this story wasn't true, that Crenshaw had lost his leg in a sawmill accident, and that's certainly possible. But on the other hand, this was also the part of the family that maintained the cells in the attic hadn't been used for slaves, but to store fruits and vegetables, which seems unlikely considering how hot it gets up in that attic in the summer months. Regardless, Crenshaw's salt operations came to a halt a short time later, and most of the slaves were sold off. By 1850, he only owned three slaves, a cook and two household servants. Soon, they would be gone too. During the Civil War, Crenshaw moved away from Hickory Hill into a house closer to Equality. He continued to own his farm, and money still came in from his lumber and banking interests, but the days of extravagant wealth were over. He died on December 4th, 1871, and left only $4,000 to his widow in his estate, a small fraction of the money he'd accumulated over his lifetime. John Crenshaw was buried in Hickory Hill Cemetery, northeast of his former home. Whether he rests there in peace is unknown, but there have been stories told for over a century that claim the slaves who lived and died in chains at Hickory Hill do not. The stories of the ghost became so well known they were even included in a book about historic homes printed by the Illinois State Historical Society in 1954. Within its pages, one account noted, "Mysterious voices can be heard in that attic, sometimes moaning, sometimes singing the spirituals that comfort heavy hearts." And that account only scratched the surface of the many tales of the old slave house. Back in the 1990s and before, I visited the old slave house dozens of times. I have memories of going there with relatives who lived in the area when I was very young and seeing the chains and whipping posts on display. When I was older, I always found the attic of the house a disturbing place. I'm not sure if it was because of its reputation or because of some lingering presence, but I always felt my heart clench a little bit when I climbed that old staircase to the third floor. The old slave quarters were usually hot and cramped, but at other times, there were mysterious chills that I couldn't easily explain. The last owner of the house was a man named George Sisk. Over the last few years, the house was open. I got to know him fairly well. He was a funny, outgoing, and pretty eccentric guy, but he loved to talk about the house's history. I once asked him if he believed in ghosts and whether he thought they haunted Hickory Hill. "Well, the house is haunted," he insisted. "I don't know if I believe in ghosts, but I respect them." It was a curious statement, especially when he followed it by telling me that he rarely went upstairs. He'd had something unsettling happen to him in the front parlor on the second floor, the ladies' parlor where Cynthia Crenshaw entertained her guests. He'd never talk about what happened, but I later found out that others had experienced voices, footsteps, and being touched by unseen hands in that room. Stranger still, he told me he never went into the house's attic unless he absolutely had to. And on those occasions, he never stayed for long. And if no visitors were in the house, the door to the attic was always kept locked. While some of the descendants of John Crenshaw later disputed some of the stories the Sisk family told about the house, it was impossible to deny that ghosts became an essential part of the fabric of the house's history over the years. But despite what some people have claimed, the Sisk family did not create the ghost stories of the old slave house. Those stories began with the scores of visitors who flocked to the house over the years and who encountered something they couldn't explain. The house was sold by the Crenshaw family in 1906 to A.J. Sisk, George's great-grandfather. The Sisks farmed the neighboring land and lived in the house for nearly two decades before its reputation spread outside the immediate area and people came, literally, knocking at their door. Visitors began dropping by the house at all hours of the day and night, asking for a tour or asking to see the attic. They heard about it from a local waitress or a gas station attendant as they were passing through. This was the 1920s, when automobiles began to be affordable to families and people were starting to travel, especially in the summer months. Well, after the Sisk family discovered the whipping posts and the balls and chains in the barn out back, they felt the legends of the house had been confirmed and knew that's what people wanted to see. So thanks to some savvy advertising, the old slave house became a destination point for so many travelers and tourists that the owners began charging admission to the house in 1930. For just a dime, or nickel if you were under 12, you could tour the place where, quote, slavery existed in Illinois, as the road signs put it. And Hickory Hill quickly became one of the most visited sites in southern Illinois. And soon, it would gain a reputation as one of the most haunted ones, too. The tourists who began arriving started to report odd things about the house. In the attic, they claimed they heard strange cries, noises, whimpers, and even the rattling of chains. Others spoke of uncomfortable feelings in the former slave quarters, like sensations of intense fear, sadness, and the unmistakable feeling of being watched. Cold chills accompanied many of these encounters, along with being touched by invisible hands and the feeling of unseen figures brushing past them. The rumors of a haunting didn't keep the tourists away. In fact, it brought even more of them to the house. Newspapers far and wide not only wrote about the old slave house as an area of attraction, but as one infested with ghosts. Well, the troublesome ghosts eventually got the attention of a ghost chaser and publicity hound named Hickman Whittington, a 69-year-old man from Benton, Illinois. After taking out a series of newspaper advertisements claiming that he had invented a de-haunting system that used a secret biblical formula for getting rid of spooks and spirits, he was challenged with cleaning out the ghosts of the old slave house. Hickman made news in local papers and even with the Associated Press when he decided to accept the challenge. He had offers in many states, he claimed, but felt the spirits at Hickory Hill were most in need of his services. On February 7, 1938, he traveled to the house and locked himself alone in the attic. He wouldn't allow anyone to observe his work because his methods were so secret, he had to protect them against anyone who might try and steal them. Well, he remained in the house for an hour, working his secret formulas of Bible verses, and then he departed, announcing that only time would tell if his methods had worked, but he was convinced the place was now ghost-free. Well, it wasn't, but we'll get back to that. According to a descendant of Hickman Whittington that I spoke with years ago, he was in fine health when he left the old slave house, but just after arriving home, he sat down to have dinner and simply fell over dead into a plate of mashed potatoes. You might say, I was told, that something scared him to death. But it turned out that story wasn't exactly accurate. Hickman Whittington didn't drop dead after his visit to Hickory Hill, but he did have a string of bad luck after he left. His ghost chasing business failed, and soon he was in the newspaper again because of a very messy divorce from his wife of 36 years. I'm not sure why she'd want to divorce him. The following year, in July 1939, Whittington checked himself into the state insane asylum in Anna, Illinois, after suffering a mental breakdown. He died a short time later, his days of chasing spooks forgotten. Even though Hickman failed to get rid of the ghosts at the old slave house, he did become part of its history. And the tall tale about how he dropped dead just hours after visiting the house gave birth to the most enduring story of the house, which was that no one could spend the entire night in the attic. Now, that story was told and retold for one simple reason. A lot of people tried it, and they all failed. George Sisk didn't know what people were experiencing up there, but he often recalled the good sense that two young Marines had when they left before something disastrous happened, as he put it. Jerry Brown and Danny Hunter came to visit the old slave house on April 23, 1966. They were both U.S. Marines and had recently returned from serving in Vietnam. They asked the Sisks for permission to spend the night in the attic, and the family agreed. Jerry and Danny left for supplies and came back around 8 p.m. with chairs, sleeping bags, and a kerosene lamp. Things were going well, according to their story, until about midnight, when they started hearing sounds coming from all over the attic. They could hear knocking, moaning, and voices like a group of people talking together. George Sisk later recalled to me, "They came flying down the stairs at about 1:30 in the morning, said they saw forms coming at them. They were in a state of shock. I really didn't get to talk to them for very long. They tore out of here in a hurry and didn't even bother to go back upstairs to get their belongings." Jerry and Danny were still shaking when they left. Both men had seen action in the service, but were too frightened by whatever had visited them in the attic of Hickory Hill to stick around. They had not been the first ones to attempt to stay, nor the last. Dozens tried, and none were successful. The two Marines had been certain they'd be the first, scoffing when they were told that others had fled the house in terror, the same way they would be a few hours later. Other thrill seekers followed the Marines, but for one reason or another, no one managed to make it until daybreak in that attic. And then finally, in 1978, a broadcaster from WSIL-TV in nearby Harrisburg, Illinois, named Dave Rogers, managed to stay the night in the attic as a Halloween stunt. He managed to beat out nearly 150 previous challengers and became the first person to spend the night in the slave quarters in more than a century. George Sisk never believed he'd make it through the night, and in fact, predicted he would flee the house before 1 a.m. He told newspapers, "Other reporters before Rogers had tried to stay the night, but none of them made it. They all said they heard shuffling feet and whimpering cries in the slave quarters at night." Rogers later admitted that he was feeling queasy when going into the house and said that his experience in the attic was anything but uneventful. He reported the next morning, "I heard a lot of strange noises. I was actually shaking. The place is so spooky. The tape recorder was picking up sounds that I wasn't hearing." He felt pretty good about himself afterward, but confessed that he didn't want to make the venture an annual event. Well, Rogers may have conquered the attic that night, but this didn't end the attempts to duplicate his feat. Dozens of others tried, but only a handful ever made it all night. The Sisks eventually had to stop allowing people to stay after one group knocked over a lantern and started a small fire. So yeah, they ruined it for everybody. But just because the overnight stays stopped, the ghost stories didn't. Those reports from tourists and ghost enthusiasts alike continued. One incident was even witnessed by George himself, the guy who always maintained he wasn't sure if he believed in ghosts. A woman came down from the attic one day and asked about the peculiar things going on up there. George and his wife Janice followed the woman back to the attic, and she showed them how in certain locations all the hair on her arms would stand on end. She demanded to know why it was happening, but of course neither of the Sisks could tell her. When I first started writing about ghosts in Illinois, I included the old slave house in several books and articles. With each publication, I'd hear from more people who spoke of their own strange occurrences in the house. Things like being touched or poked by unseen hands, hearing voices and little bits of songs and music, and even full-blown figures when no one living was there. For most people, though, visits to Hickory Hill were not so bizarre. Many experienced nothing, while others said they felt unsettled or frightened in the attic. Some became so upset they burst into tears. Now, this probably couldn't be called evidence of the supernatural, but there's no denying it was an unsettling place, sometimes even for the owners. Janice Sisk insisted she believed the house was haunted and spoke a few times about her own experiences, saying she was often bothered by sounds she couldn't explain. She once told me, "I can make excuses for some of them. I tell myself it's the wind, but one night we were lying in bed, I heard a loud crash like glass breaking. Thinking that a window had broken, we got up to investigate, but there was nothing broken. Another sound that shook me up tremendously happened one night when I was lying in bed. There was a sound like something or someone banging from under the floor with a hammer. I clearly heard it three times, but what it was, I don't know." Dating back to the 1930s and the visit from ghost chaser Hickman Whittington, the house became a frequent stopping place for ghost hunters, psychic investigators, and self-proclaimed experts on ghosts. George kept a number of books left behind by those visitors, as well as a scrapbook of newspaper clippings about visits by people like Hans Holzer and others. By the time I'd met him, he'd lost track of how many interviews he'd given about the hauntings at the old slave house. He said that most of the ghost hunters who came, and keep in mind this was back in the days before all the television shows, those ghost hunters were historians at heart who wanted to look for ghosts and soak up some of the rich background of the place. Others, however, like Ed and Lorraine Warren, dropped in and demanded to exorcise the place. They told the Sisks that if they weren't allowed to do it, a negative energy would enter the bodies of the Sisk family and possess them. The Sisks politely declined their offer. As George told me, "We decided that whatever's upstairs can stay there. I believe in leaving things like that alone." And today, nearly 28 years since my last visit to the old slave house, whatever still walks in that house walks alone. In late 1996, Hickory Hill was closed to the public. The declining health of George and Janice, along with the expensive upkeep of the house, forced George to try and sell it. For several years, Illinois state agencies danced around the controversial history of the house and ran into problems with George's eccentric behavior before finally buying the place from him in 1999. Although it initially appeared the state of Illinois might reopen it, they never did. It remains today shuttered and dark. The wind still howls through the dark recesses of the attic, and the old wooden floor still creaks with the footsteps of those who were once imprisoned there. But there's no one present to experience it. What will become of the old slave house and its resident ghosts remains unknown. There's more ahead for the show, so stay with us through these important messages from our sponsors.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? And I don't mean like spells or incantations to trap spirits, you weirdos. I mean like a new language that could help you start communicating with more people on this plane today. Then I need to tell you about Rosetta Stone. Look, you know the brand, you know the name. They have the expertise and a 30-year legacy, which makes them more qualified than ever to help you learn a new language today. They've helped millions of people build the fluency and confidence to speak new languages. Now, this is the part where Troy would tell me that I made some kind of grammatical error, but he's not here right now, so like, I don't know, it's like speaking tongues. Rosetta Stone focuses on speaking practice for real-life scenarios to get you ready for real conversations with real people. Or maybe you can even learn how to use some different types of Ouija boards. I don't know. Either way, Rosetta Stone can help you learn faster and retain your new language better. Honestly, Rosetta Stone really would have come in handy for season 4 of New Orleans because I know we butchered some of those French names, and I apologize once again. Now, you all know I have a 9-to-5 job when I'm not at the podcast factory, and Rosetta Stone actually helped me not make a total fool out of myself while I was in Brazil interviewing celebrities. Obrigado. And now I want to help you. So don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, American Hauntings podcast listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Rosetta Stone, how language is learned. Wait, by the way, Troy, like where do words come from? Hey, no, don't walk away. Oh, Troy, where do words...
There's one thing that the American Hauntings podcast knows about, and that's mothers. We featured a lot of great mothers in a lot of our episodes. Pearl Curran, Julia Lemp, Sarah Moore, Marie Laveau, Jane Mansfield, Tamsin Donner, Delphine LaLaurie, Belle Gunness. Okay, maybe leave out those last two. But what I'm saying is that with Mother's Day coming soon, you need a truly special gift for your mom because, well, she's not Belle Gunness. So let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that literally turns your mom's life story into a book. So here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question in her email, the same way she sends you questions about your dating life or when you plan to give her grandkids. Anyway, these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. She replies by either typing in the answers or by recording her own voice. Then MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a keepsake book, and they can create an audiobook that uses her voice recordings, preserving her voice and her stories forever. As anyone who doesn't have their mom around anymore can tell you, having your mother's stories about growing up, being a kid, and overcoming life's challenges will be something that you and your kids will treasure. And let's be honest, your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a very cool way to share them. Honestly, I decided to try this out for myself, and I sent it to my mom, and she's not exactly a whiz at computers, but she still found it really easy to use. My mom might have had a little more unusual childhood than a lot of mothers do, so I'm really glad to have this, and I think you'll be glad to give one to your mother, too. So check out mylifeinabook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's mylifeinabook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS for 10% off today.
Okay, I'm ready to go when you are, man.
Okay, all right. Welcome back to American Hauntings, and let me just say thanks to all of you who've returned for episode number 3 of our new season. I'm the writer, narrator, and creator of American Hauntings, Troy Taylor, and with me is our producer and co-host and the man behind the scenes, the wizard behind the curtain, Cody Beck.
Dang, that just makes it seem like I'm a phony back there.
No, it doesn't. It's the man pulling all the strings. Just because he couldn't actually give anyone hearts or brains didn't mean he didn't have some idea about what he was doing. Emerald City, right? I mean, you know.
That's very true. I think the comparison is accurate because for the longest time, didn't know what the hell I was doing, but
yeah,
kind of made it work, you know.
You know, so.
Troy, I got to go to your museum yesterday. I know we're going to talk about it, but it was awesome.
Yeah, I appreciate anybody who's listening. And I talked to a lot of you yesterday who said that you listened to the podcast, which was great. But everybody who came out to the grand opening of the American Oddities Museum yesterday, which would have been March 9th on Saturday, we had a much larger than I expected turnout. I had no idea. I had no idea how many people would come.
It was packed.
We were jammed in there. I mean, it was 3 or 4 deep in front of cases, you know, and stuff. But it was fun. It was really a lot of fun. Fired up the popcorn popper, you know, and stuff. Mm-hmm. It was fun. So anyway, I'll be adding to the museum. I've already got, that was the thing I had to explain to a couple people when I was there. It's like, guys, I had 2 weeks to get this together. And everybody's like, well, yeah, you know, that's good. You can't tell. And I'm like,
you crushed it,
you know, you know, it was a lot of hard work for a couple of weeks. But now, I mean, I've got more stuff that I just didn't have. I couldn't get to in time. I mean, I was there late Friday night trying to finish everything up before we opened. So, it was a lot of fun. So, you know, hopefully people will be able to come back and visit again because we'll be adding stuff all the time. Yeah. I've already got lines on stuff that, I mean, I've already got some stuff that's going to go in like next week. And I've got lines from some people who are going to get me some stuff to put on display. So it's going to be very cool. So, but anyway, thanks to everybody who came out. Cause it was a real blast. It really was.
It's a big space. It's really, really cool. I have some questions. Two things. Do you know, like, are you going to be kind of like open certain times or how's that working?
Yeah. We're open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Every weekend, 12 to 5. I think we're closed Easter. I mean, like if it's a holiday falls in there, we'll be closed, but otherwise it'll be every Friday and Saturday and Sunday. So, but noon to 5, every weekend, and it's $5 to get in. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's it. It's a $5 ticket, and you can spend hours just going through the stuff that's in there, you know, that's in there already, let alone stuff that we'll be adding. So, there's a museum bookstore. And after you actually, if you spend $25 in the store, in the bookstore, you get 2 free passes. So, I mean,
perfect.
That's, you know, said buy some books, get in for free kind of thing. So, but yeah, anyway, we hope people will come and check it out if they haven't yet. I don't think we've already, you know, got through everyone who, who listens to the show, who lives in the area. So come back and see us and come back again sometime. I think you'll enjoy it. So
you said you're going to be adding to it and you have lines on certain things. Is there anything in particular? I don't know if you want to share anything, but is there anything you're looking for you can't find?
Oh, no. I don't want to talk about what I've got already. Uh-huh. I don't want to do that. So
you don't
want
to want everything to be a surprise. Nothing.
No, okay. I haven't. I won't know. I can't find it until I can't find it.
Got it. Fair enough.
I'm doing well so far, and I have a huge list of things that I want to add that I've already started adding. So, yeah, I don't want to talk about what I'm going to add.
Perfect. You did tell me.
But
about
I am adding things.
You told me about one case you're going to do, and I'm really excited for it. I think it's great.
Yeah. So it's going to be cool. So it's been fun so far. It is one of those things that really grabs like so many things I like to do. And I was already hunting for weird stuff anyway, but now I've got a much bigger list of weird things to hunt for. So it's going to be
great. Yeah, man.
So, yeah.
That's awesome. I don't know how you found the time, but not like you're doing anything else, right?
Keeps me off the streets. That's what I always say. So anyway, but speaking of things we don't have time for, but we're doing it because we love it, is the conference is coming up in June. We have already registered so many people that we'd already be sold out if we were having it at our old place, at our old location we used to do at the hotel. So get signed up if you haven't yet. We've still got workshops and tours that are available. I'm planning on possibly adding something else as an early arrival thing on Thursday night, because we've already jam-packed the thing with Brandon. We're down to like the last two seats on that. So we're thinking about adding something else that evening. We'll see. That's not a for sure thing yet. I'll know soon. But we do have really good workshops, really good events still left. And of course, the conference itself, I think even if I wasn't doing it and didn't have to be there, I'd still go. And yeah. I don't say that very often, because it's that's work, but I would actually go to ours. So it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun. So
yeah, last year, the Friday night early entertainment was someone telling me to go do stand up pretty much and entertain people.
We won't do that again. Don't worry.
Damn it. I just vamped for like 30 minutes and then they gave me, I had trivia questions and sometimes I didn't even know the answer. It was everybody had a good time though.
It was funny. It was very funny. So, all right. Well, also one last thing before we get into the meat of this show and some of our other stuff. I want to remind everybody, we just launched the new season of our Dead Men Do Tell Tales Patreon show on our Patreon supporter account. That means we've got three full seasons that people can binge if you haven't checked it out yet. And we just started season four. We've had two episodes up so far. We post those every other week. So that means that if you're a Patreon supporter, you get a new show, you get this show and you get the Patreon show the next week. So there's no waiting for shows in between. You get something every week. And this season, we're doing two different stories at the same time. We're doing Ed Gein, the maniacal madman from Wisconsin. And we're also doing the making of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And that has been a lot of fun for me anyway, switching back and forth, because they're two very different stories. I mean, one based on the other story loosely, but they're two very different stories to get to tell. Because I got to talk last week about how the house where they did most of the primary filming, that the entire yard was a big, right, giant pot field, and that the owners had told them, well, you guys can sample all you want, just don't tell anybody. So, which tells you a lot about the movie. A little behind the scenes stuff going on there. So that was a lot of fun. So anyway, and then of course you got Ed Gein, who's, in love with his mother and, chopping people up. So if you are interested in checking out the show, you can sign up for our Patreon support. You could get the show at the lowest base support that you can get it at is $5. $5. I mean, you can't even buy coffee for $5.
That's
it. You get a month of stuff on our Patreon. So check it out. It's patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. Hauntings. Yeah. I was just about to say, I know you have the list of new Patreon people. You should have a list of that. So I'll let you jump into that before we go any further.
Yeah, sure. So thank you very much for supporting the show to Denise, Robert, Jennifer, Michelle, and Sarah.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
And they're all losing their appetites on a regular basis as
yes.
they listen to the show, or will be soon, because it's just going to get grimmer. So anyway, if you have a comment about the show, quick question you'd like to have answered, you can email Cody, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but you can email Cody at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com, or you can text us on the awesome haunt line, which is 217-791-7859. And we might read that on the show. I've got some new ones that I wanted to get to. Let's see. Now I've got to find where I left off, because we were trying to talk about that last week. So here we go. So I have a few of those I want to read, and then we will we'll get on to some of our other stuff here. So this one comes from Jamie. She's in the 217, And she say, hey, first I wanted to say you did such a great job on the dinner tour in Alton in October. Husband, I had a blast. Anyway, I'm texting because I just became a state worker and apparently the building that I'm in is haunted. It's right down the road from Springfield High. I should have noted that 217 for anyone who doesn't know is Central Illinois. So that would be Springfield, Illinois, not the one from The Simpsons or anything like that. I think everyone knows the story of Springfield High School, but my question is, how far down Washington did the old Hutchinson Cemetery go? Just curious if that could have something to do with the haunting. Thanks. Keep up the great work. Excited about the new season. So she's talking about Springfield High School was built on a there was an epidemic in the 1840s in Springfield, and they had a cemetery that was moved into a field that was later kind of forgotten about. Mm-hmm. And so there's a school built on top of that cemetery. Now, the bodies were supposed to have been moved, but you know how that goes.
Right. We know how it goes.
We've heard that story a lot. So that's a good question. I haven't seen anything that really shows like exact measurements or anything of exactly where that was. I mean, other than very roughly. So it's a possibility, but I mean, you're also, you know, I'm not sure about the details on the building, but you work for the state. So that in itself, you know, could have leave a lot of lingering agony behind right. working for the state of Illinois.
Traumatic experiences.
They're traumatic experiences that they are stuck reliving. So, it's hard to say exactly what that might be caused by, but it certainly could have something to do with that cemetery because everybody's always believed that that's what's going on with that school. And there are a lot of stories about the high school and the strange things there. So
That's a triple whammy right there.
School, I know, right? School,
the state cemetery. I know.
And you know, they buried it because it was or used it for a burial ground because the main cemetery downtown just overflowed. I mean, because of this epidemic. So it was a mess, but that's where like the Lincoln's first son that died very young was buried in the old cemetery and then later was moved and then moved again after his father was buried out at Oak Ridge in Springfield.
So. What was the disease that was going around for that epidemic?
I believe that one was, I want to say it was cholera, but I'm not sure if it was. I'd have to look, but I'm pretty sure it was because it was right around that time. There were a lot of them. And cholera was a real bad one. And I think it was cholera.
So, gotcha.
Yeah. Okay. So this one comes from the 618. Actually, this one comes from our friend Tim Biggs in the 618. Just want to let you know, I'm really enjoying the new season. The Corpsewood Manor episode was sad and creepy. I wanted to give a couple of unsolicited opinions for my fellow listeners. Okay. First of you, oh God, this is just Tim. Like, all right, I'm going to go ahead and read this, but if I had read it through, because I'm really bad about not reading all the way through. Uh-huh. If I had read this all the way through, I wouldn't probably, I love Tim, but I would not have read this because first, if you get the chance to go on the River Road tour to Pier Marquette, stories are great. The stops are cool. And the food at the lodge is amazing. I didn't want to just read something about him bragging about our stuff. But anyway, we met some great folks that night from the Dead of Winter event. Also, the Patreon episodes have been great. I highly suggest signing up. So
anyway,
he also says, unfortunately, due to my drive, I'm all caught up. So I did some major binging, but I'm all right. LOL. Look forward to seeing you at the Bonnie and Clyde dinner and spirits. Glad to hear Cody back on the air. See you soon.
Hey.
So he's a good dude. So
that's great. Thanks, Tim.
This one is from Bob Zanglungo. He writes in, we had an ongoing conversation. We were talking about some stuff that wasn't necessary for the podcast. We both agreed, but we were just chatting. So that's sometimes that what happens with the text line. It catches my interest and you just get replies instead of reading.
Nice.
But this one was fun though, because he said, hey, Troy, thanks so much for saying that Ed Gein makes you nauseated. I feel the same way. It creeps me out to no end, but I can't not listen to the Patreon podcast. I'll just be listening during the daylight hours. So, that was Bob in the, I've got it in the phone now because I don't know where he is calling from because it is in the 860. So I wanted to throw that in there. Anyway, and then this one is, this one was just kind of funny. It's from the 586 and it says, "Hey, good morning. I have actively listening to an episode where you said you didn't have any texts, so I wanted to send you one."
Oh.
Yeah. So you guys are fantastic to listen to. I've been listening for years. I look forward to every episode. And you've made my last two New Orleans trips so much better. B, any chance you're going to look at Detroit for some fantastic ghost and crime stories? Love to help with the research. But you never know. You know, this we don't have any plans on stopping anytime soon. So you just never know where we might end up. So anyway, that is from Jess in the 586. So, yeah, I've somehow become like everybody's like go-to New Orleans travel guide. So it's
rightfully
it's
like, so.
I know everybody. I get emails and messages all the time. Hey, so what tour did you tell me? Where should I eat? So I don't mind. It's funny, but it's just funny that when I see them pop up. So. Yeah, that's fun. Anyway, this one is from the 847, but it's also from our friend. Wrong one. We'll get to that one in a second. It's from Rick. I thought it was this one is from the 847. Listening to your feedback about the Myrtles Plantation for the bonus episode. We get a lot of Myrtles Plantations things in these. I've been getting a lot of them. Funny enough, I stayed there as a kid with my mom and had no idea it was haunted until we went down for breakfast the next morning. Another guest swore up and down she saw Chloe, and another person chimed in saying, "That's impossible. There is no Chloe." She says, "I have no idea how that conversation evolved or who the other guest was." But anyway, she said it's disheartening when even tour guides rehash stories that are purely based in fiction because the real history is such is much more interesting. So, but that one was from the... also from the 847. This one is the one I was going to say is from our friend Rick Ray and his wife Jan. He is over in the 314, the St. Louis area. He says, "Greetings from the Myrtles Plantation." He texted us from there.
Wow.
"We decided to take a side trip on our way to New Orleans and do an evening tour and re-listen to the podcast on the way, but we will be nice and not correct our tour guide." He's also a police officer.
Okay.
Sheriff. So yeah. And most importantly, happy to hear Cody back in the saddle. Anyway, and that's from Rick and Jan. Rick is a good dude. So that made me laugh when I saw that. And I thought, boy, I don't think if he corrected me, I would just say, "Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yeah. Thank you." Yep. And shut up. But yeah, no, he's a good guy. So
yeah, we don't argue with cops anymore.
No, there's no point. Just ask for a lawyer. Every time I see him, I just immediately ask for a lawyer. So just kidding. Anyway. All right. So you ready to talk about this episode?
Yeah, I did have a couple things real quick.
Okay. Of course. Yeah, absolutely.
One, I wanted to say thank you for everybody that's, you know, saying they're happy I'm back and everything.
Yeah, because I mean,
I read all the emails and I appreciate
not,
everybody.
I'm not, but you are. No, I'm just kidding. It's a joke. I'm glad you're back because this sucks doing it by yourself. You would not believe, I mean, how boring it was trying to do that episode by myself where I'm just talking to myself. And I don't know, you know, people, they will be listening, but they're not. It's like being on the radio. Being on the radio is a perfect job for someone like me who is an introvert. Mm-hmm. Who really doesn't, you know, likes to be behind the scenes and talk about stuff and just talk and goof around. And you don't have to deal with people until, you know, then you have to go deal with people. So
right.
That's great. This isn't radio. So while I'm talking, there is no one listening, no one giving me any feedback. I know someone's going to hear it in a few days, and then maybe I'll hear from people. Maybe I won't. And so sitting here staring at myself on the screen talking was really, really not fun. So I am very glad you're back. And I'm glad everyone else is too. And I only interrupted you because, well, why wouldn't I? Because you're back. That's why.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, thank you very much. Can I just jump in with a listener review real quick?
This
is a fun one.
Oh, shoot. I missed that. I'm so sorry.
Okay.
I missed that on the sheet.
It's
so you
all
put
good.
Me in charge of things. And then I just, you know, we just are all over the place.
Tripped right at the finish line. This one's from J9223. It's titled "Listen, Just Listen." I found this podcast about 3 weeks ago. I work alone as a mobile dog groomer, so Cody and Troy are now my daily coworkers, and I cannot stop. I'm coming up on the end of season 3 and cannot get enough. I love the combination of history, legend, and folklore. And yes, Troy, I listened to the end. Keep up the killer work. I'll be sure to keep binging. So thank you so much. I thought that's
nice.
That's
good. You know? Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, very nice.
Yeah, but let's talk
someone's
about
dog walker coworkers.
And I'm down for that.
I am too. I'm good with that. So
heck yeah. Let's talk about this episode.
Okay. Well, this was one just to kind of set the scene for you. Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, you saw the whole episode, so it's not like you don't know where I'm going with things, but this was on the list no matter what. As soon as I knew that this season was going to be about haunted houses, and while not specifically a murder house, the deaths in this location are rumor / legend, but you know, there's a lot of, there's a lot of evidence that you could say may not be like solid forensic evidence, but there's a lot of circumstantial evidence about everything that went on in this house, and no reason not to believe it based on the fact that he's been legally tied into a lot of things. Anyway, mm-hmm. So my point is, this is not specifically a murder house like most of them are, but I had to include it because this is my first haunted house in my whole life. I remember going there. I have family from Southern Illinois, so we used to go down there to visit when I was a kid, when we'd be back in the area. And they weren't too far away from here. I mean, in probably an hour or so, because it was they were around McLeansboro. And so we would go down there and go to the old slave house. And I remember my dad taking me there, and I couldn't have been more than 5 or 6.
Wow.
And I specifically remember going out, and there were big salt kettles that sat out in the yard, and there were posts there, and there were chains and manacles then with balls, big iron balls on them, and remember asking about what those were for. Oof. And stuff. Yeah. And I was a little kid, and this was the first like that I, you know, that I would grow up and know, ooh, that's a haunted house. Mm-hmm. You know, that this was the first one that I really have any clear memories of.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. So it was one I definitely wanted to include, even though, you know, it's not like I can send anybody there to visit, you know, because I don't think it'll ever reopen, but maybe it will. Maybe we'll all be surprised. But
yeah, cool. Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Thanks for sharing that. I have a few questions then.
Yeah, of course.
So what's the third floor? Is it like what they tried to make American Horror Story Coven, the LaLaurie kind of house, or is it different?
Well, that whole story, I mean, you'll remember when we talked about that, it's the same kind of situation. And actually the weird thing was, you're talking about something taking place around the same time. Mm. You know, as in that story with Madame LaLaurie, and, you know, steering away from American Horror Story Coven, which, yes, yeah, it is still my favorite one, but let's be honest, there's nothing realistic about it. But
sure.
But going back to the actual story that we talked about in our New Orleans season, you know, it was a place where the slaves were kept up on the top floor of the house. Now, you know, the wild legends of Madame LaLaurie was that she was, you know, remember when she was conducting experiments and things, and there's mm-hmm. zero evidence of anything like that. You know, none of that was reported in the paper, but the poor condition of the slaves was. And so putting them up on the third floor of the house is kind of eerie, you know, when you compare the two stories. But in this particular case, these were not, you know, he later had a couple of household servants. Those were the last ones that he had. But prior to that, these slaves were nothing more than field hands. I mean, mm-hmm. they were hard at labor, you know, for the most part, working in the salt mines. You know, you've heard that expression, you know, back to the salt mines, you know,
yeah.
And most people have no idea what that means. And salt mines aren't like a gold mine or a coal mine or something. You don't dig down into the ground. They're big wet marshes of salt water, like heavy salt water, like the Great Salt Lake thick. Mm-hmm. And they're not common. They're, you know, that's why when they find these, you know, they would find what they called reservations of them in Virginia, and then later at the end of the story in Ohio. But these Southern Illinois salt lines, I mean, that's where Saline County got its name. You know,
uh-huh.
But that involved hauling all the water out of the swamp, boiling it down in these giant kettles. And it would take, I mean, it was backbreaking, brutal, hot, terrible work. Nobody wanted to do it. So it's just like, you know, it would, as our, the country would become, you're picking lettuce and you're picking fruit and stuff. And so it's, you know, it's Okies with no money coming out of the Dust Bowl going to California, or it's immigrants coming up from Mexico. And they're, you know, it's the same thing. Nobody wanted to pay a decent wage to do this stuff because it was hard to make money, but you couldn't find anybody who would do it. So they would just, in this case, they convinced the state government to allow them to rent slaves, essentially, and bring them into Illinois to work. And that's, you know, it's kind of skipping around the whole idea of that we don't allow slavery in the state. Well, we kind of did, you know, there were those exceptions that I mentioned in the story, but, you know, this was horrible, horrible work, and they kept them up on the third floor. And I've got photographs. I've got some photographs, but to try to explain it to you, when you would come up the stairs to that third floor, it was like an attic staircase, very narrow, you know, right against the wall, the old worn steps. It was nothing like the rest of the house. And when you come up to the attic, it was all unfinished, but there was this wide hallway that went down the middle, and on each side were small rooms. All the rooms had doors on them at one time. A lot of them had been dismantled over the years. I had read some things, some reports and records that said that some of the bunks that were in the rooms had been taken out and turned into like hog troughs and things like that for animals by the families who came after the Crenshaws. The Sisk family, when they moved in, they used a lot of that wood and things for that. But there were, you know, marks on the walls where the iron rings were, and a lot of the rings were still there. There were bars on the doors, on the windows of the doors. And it was brutal. I mean, it was not a welcoming spot, as you might imagine. And, you know, that's where all of these stories took root from. You know, not only did you have this grow into, hey, this guy's got slaves here, and it became famous for that around the state, but then that's where the ghost stories came from too. When people started visiting the place and started having experiences, most of those experiences happened up on that third floor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I don't know how much I want to bounce around, but I definitely have more questions. Okay. I was thinking Equality Illinois. It's like the slogan could be like, we pay everyone very little.
Oh, I know. Yeah. You know, and you know, it didn't turn into equality until like the 1920s. I mean, it was years later. I mean, it was a long time afterward. I mean, it was originally, it was U.S. Salines for a long, long time. And then they finally changed the name and made it Equality, which I found odd. But, yeah, you know, I'm not sure what I ought to look that up, I guess, and see what the reason for the name. I could understand the name change, but why equality?
You're trying to bury the past.
Maybe that's a possibility. I mean, it can't be anything anybody was all that excited about. So, but right. Again, you have to remember that. And I don't know how much we've talked about this on the show, because we haven't done a whole lot of Southern Illinois stuff. I mean, I deal with it a lot because of, you know, other research that I do and stuff, but Southern Illinois was mostly settled by immigrants who came up from Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia, and that area. So they brought a lot of their traditions with them. And so when they came up, I mean, that's regrettably, I guess, in some ways, that's where most of my family came from, North Carolina, into Kentucky, into the Appalachians, and into Southern Illinois. That's where they came. And so coming up into that area, they brought their, you know, their love for homemade whiskey and, you know, and their feelings about slavery and things in a lot of cases. So, you know, people probably in the 1830s and early 1840s, were not all that up in arms for the most part about what was going on, at least the general public. I'm sure some people were enraged about the fact that Crenshaw was, you know, accused of, I mean, kidnapping. Slavery is one thing, I guess, at that time. I mean, it's all wrong and it would have always been wrong. But when you're just like kidnapping like free people who live down the street that have never been slaves and selling them into slavery, because one of the things you have to remember is that in 1809, they stopped allowing anyone to import slaves into the country. You couldn't bring them in anymore, so you had to make your own. You know, so kidnapping, you know, they were filling a shortage of people, of, you know, human tools or
supply and demand. Yeah,
exactly. And so, you know, this was still early in the 19th century and, you know, years before the Civil War. And, you know, it was still a heated topic, obviously, and still wrong, but people were felt differently about it back then. And
yeah,
so, you know, that's why they always think that, you know, like when the sawmill caught on fire and things, they think that it was probably other African Americans who had set the place on fire and not just, you know, a bunch of white guys from town, you know, who are not going to care one way or the other.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know this is it's probably very, very messy, but you said white residents could also be fined or whipped if they provided any sort of assistance to a runaway slave or if they brought a slave into Illinois for the purpose of allowing them freedom. So if a slave escapes the South, comes into Illinois, how do those laws work then? They're not.
Well, the thing free? Is, they're well, they're technically no. Well, they're technically still. Well, and see, that's boy, you re- we it's really messy. We'd have to really dig into this. But there were a lot of different laws passed, fugitive slave laws, about what could be done to try to appease the South, you know, because the South was angry when, you know, we divided the country, you know, when slavery, when states would come in for a while, it was like every other one. And then it was the Mason-Dixon line. And then that was how you're going to divide where slavery was. And the South really felt like they were getting shorted on this stuff. And they were being, you know, people were against them because of slavery, which they felt was essential to their economy, which it was because it was built on such a shaky foundation, kind of like the salt mines were. But anyway, so, you know, there were laws that were passed to try to, you know, to appease the South.
And say,
okay, well, listen, if somebody escapes, then, you know, we'll send them back. And if you help them, you know, legally, if you help them, you know, when we talked about this some in the Alton season too, you know, if you help a slave escape, then you are just as guilty as the escape slave because it's someone's property. So you're a thief by helping them escape. Or if you, you know, smuggle them over the, you know, a state line into Illinois or, you know, or Wisconsin or wherever, you know, whatever free state you bring them into, you are held responsible for that. You can be, you know, charged, you could be fined, you could be put in jail for it. So these were kind of the things that people were dealing with at the time, you know, especially the abolitionists who were trying to help people escape from slavery. And that's why the Underground Railroad, the original thing, was so secretive, and why there are no written records, and why we have to go by, you know, well, it's very possible that this was a place or that was a place, but nobody can say for sure. And that's what's happened with this situation too. Now we've got a guy who's doing things backwards, who's, you know, kidnapping free blacks and selling them into slavery, or, you know, when they come north, capturing them, either turning them in for a fee or taking them back down to Kentucky or somewhere and selling them off and making even more money. So that became a reverse Underground Railroad. And again, people will say, oh, but there's no proof of that. Well, there's no proof of the Underground Railroad either. That's the whole point. You have to go by your circumstantial evidence. And, you know, we all believe that the Underground Railroad was real. So why not the alternative? You know, and because Crenshaw was hauled into court several times for charged with kidnapping, and it was sued by people for, you know, being involved in kidnappings, I think it's very safe to say that, you know, the rumors that got started were accurate, or at least really, really, you know, close to as accurate as we believe they are.
Got it. Okay. I want to shift gears here real quick. There are a couple earlier questions. What was the great New Madrid earthquake?
Oh, that's, have you ever heard the expression when they talk about how the Mississippi River ran backward?
Yes.
Yeah. In 1811 and 1812, there was a massive series of earthquakes that hit the central part of the country, centered around New Madrid, Missouri, down around Cape Girardeau, that area. Okay. Yeah, down around that area. And, you know, it did cause the Mississippi to run backward. It changed the entire landscape of the region. It created entire lakes. And it was said that if that area had been populated at the time, by, you know, say the same amount of people that were out east somewhere. Let's say if it hit Boston in 1811 instead of, you know, middle of nowhere in Missouri, where you had some settlers and Native Americans and things. If it had hit a big city, it would have been the deadliest earthquake in world history. That's how big it was. So the New Madrid Fault runs down right through the middle of the country. Now you're really going to get me wound up on because this is one of my favorite topics.
Okay.
This fault runs right down through the middle, right along the Mississippi River. And it's a fault line, just like the ones they have in California. And occasionally we have earthquakes still to this day. Every once in a while, there'll be a small one. It's some tremors, you know, a 4.7 or something. And you barely feel a lot of that stuff. But another massive earthquake, like the one in 1811, we're actually past due for that to happen.
Oh, great.
Like 20 years past due. So at any moment, the entire middle of the country could collapse and become this giant lake right in the middle of North America. Wow. Because Alton would be gone, St. Louis would be gone. And to make things even scarier, along the Mississippi River, from south to north, all the way up the river, massive power plants have been built to take advantage of the hydroelectric system created by the river. There's that one at Portage to Sioux, right near Alton. That's massive, and it provides power to most of the state of Missouri, just that one station, you know, going completely west from there. If there's another massive earthquake along the New Madrid Fault, and all of those towns are destroyed and washed and end up underwater, so will all those power plants. And if all the power plants go, it will knock out the entire electrical grid for North America. Jeez. Because of this one earthquake. Not to mention the millions of people that will die, the new coastline that will be created, you know, so you'll probably be able to buy beachfront property in Ohio or somewhere, Ohio and, you know, Nebraska or somewhere, because the middle of the country will be gone. So yeah, the New Madrid earthquake, there's a couple of great books. In fact, there's one called When the Mississippi River Ran Backward, and it's fascinating and terrifying at the same time. Once you start digging in to see what's going to happen if there's another one that big, it freaks you out, and you just can't think about it. You just can't keep thinking about it. Because if you do, you'll never leave home, and you will die in your home anyway. So it won't matter. But my point is that it's terrifying, and you will not want to live where you do.
Gosh. Yeah. I have enough made up fears in my head.
Exactly. You don't want to think about one that's a real strong possibility someday, you know?
you talked about the importance of salt, for a lot of different reasons. And something I was thinking about is, and I guess salt might be a little different, but, watching like Pirates of the Caribbean and all that sort of stuff, like spices were such a thing.
Yep. Yeah, they were. That's the reason why Marco Polo went, you know, and ended up in China. They went looking for the spice trade across Asia, from Europe, between Europe and Asia, back in the, you know, in the Renaissance period. That was guys, you know, loading up horses and going because they needed to bring back cinnamon and all these things that we had no access to, but people developed a taste and a need for it. And salt was the same kind of thing. You know, it was something that people could use and they needed, mostly as a preservative, but also for, it was a flavoring thing too. It was just like any of the other spices. Sometimes you go to antique stores, and if you don't know what they are, and then you go look and you'll see these, they're often round. They're either round or sometimes square, and they are, they're boxes, and inside of the boxes are smaller boxes, sometimes round, sometimes square. And they'll have the names of different spices on the top. And those were a treasured thing. Like, you know, we talked about like the Donner Party and all the things that got dumped out on the side of the road. Mm-hmm. You didn't throw away your spice box. Didn't matter how heavy it was, because you wanted to keep that, because it had your salt, your peppers, your anything you cooked with. And, you know, you could eat a shoe if you had some salt to put on it, right? So I'm kidding about that. But, or, you know, I'm sure it made the people taste better, speaking of the Donners.
There you go.
But that was a treasured thing. And so now when you find them in antique stores, they're usually pretty expensive. I see them for, you know, $200-$300 sometimes, and they're just beat up old metal boxes, but they were spice boxes and they were prized possessions. And so salt was important, not only as a seasoning, as a flavoring, but like I said, it did preserve meat and things. You could salt anything, pretty much, fish, you know, any buffalo, deer, anything you might kill on the trail, you know, you could keep it good for quite a while, even without drying it in the sun and using it like jerky. You could keep it fresh with meat or with salt for quite some time. So as the country was starting to grow and people were starting to spread further west, salt was in great need. Because there was no refrigeration. And unless you lived somewhere where there was plenty of ice that you could, you know, put in a dark place, you know, in, with straw and try to keep it from melting, you know, during the summer, which, you know, we talked about that. Again, we go back to our St. Louis season, talking about how they were lagering the beer and stuff. But yep. Same kind of thing. You can't preserve anything without refrigeration, and nobody had it unless you had a handy cave somewhere nearby. Mm-hmm. So having salt was essential to the time period. So yeah. People would use it for, you know, you could use it as a bartering thing, as for exchange. You know, if you needed to buy something, hey, you know, I got a pound of salt, you know, what'll get me, you know, two new shirts or whatever, you know? So yeah, that's how important it was.
So when I see when I see sea salt all the time, I always make the joke. I'm like, isn't all salt from the sea? Is that actually a difference?
No, not really. Salt? There really is a difference between salt. You know, that's why, you know, out in Utah, that, you know, there used to be, I don't know if it's still there or not, but right by the Salt Lake, because I mean, I've been hearing about how it's drying up and stuff, but there used to be a gigantic Morton salt factory there, mm-hmm. you know, just using the Salt Lake to produce salt. And then eventually they started adding, I'm probably boring you with this, and I'm sorry.
No, I'm asking.
They started adding iodine to your salt because uh-huh. people were, you know, you're getting diseases and things, and the iodine was a cure, but there was no easy way to take it. So they're like, everybody uses salt. So they just started adding it to table salt. So anytime you're at the grocery store and you pick up, you know, a thing of Morton's, it's like a mm-hmm. dollar or less. I mean, it's cheap, but it's always iodized salt because we need it. So if you buy nothing but sea salt without any iodine in it, it's not as good for you. So you should never have just other kinds of salt, like kosher salt. I mean, it's great. I mean, it's great to cook with and stuff, but you really should make sure that you continue to use iodized salt as well. It's good for your body.
I'm learning so much today. Okay. So the ghost stories, I was actually thinking, I haven't been on any ghost hunts or done anything in a long time. I think maybe this summer, depending on how I'm feeling up until then, I might jump back in and go on one and check it out. But yeah, you already talked about this, but yeah, I love the story about, you know, your first time and all that, and your first haunted house. You said George Sisk. Where else have you talked about him before? Because the name sounds familiar.
No, I haven't. I don't think I have. I mean, somebody named Sisk could have come up in another story, but it wouldn't be this family, because they're really just, as far as Southern Illinois goes, they're the ones really connected to this house. And it's a fascinating story. Again, to me, there's the kind of the stuff that I didn't want to jump too hard into, like the, you know, people going on vacation kind of thing. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. they bought this house in 1906 and they were just going to live in it. You mm-hmm. know, they had no intention of ever turning it into anything, but they'd heard the stories. They found the stuff in the house. They found the whipping posts and the salt kettles and the chains and things. So they're like, hey man, I guess these stories were true after all. And I'm sure they probably talked about it to people in town. You know, you go into to get your groceries or your supplies, and oh, God, you know what? Guess what we found? Those stories are true. So somebody mentions it to somebody else, and before long, you've got people coming through the area because the old slave house, Equality and the old slave house sit right off Highway 1 in Illinois, which is a major road, believe it or not. Well, it was at one time. It's a two-lane highway, but it runs from Chicago along the eastern border of Illinois all the way down to Cairo. So you could take Highway 1 the whole way. And so people would go down south that way. There weren't any interstates. You got to remember that too. So a two-lane highway, especially one as nice as Route 1 was back then, people were using it all the time. And so they'd come through town and they'd hear from some guy at the gas station, or they talk to a waitress at the diner, and she'd talk about the old slave house. And that was a big deal because remember, it's the 20s. We're 50, 60 years since the end of slavery, the end of the Civil War. It's a land of Lincoln. So people are still jived about Lincoln, and it hasn't been that long till these things happen. So they start showing up at their door wanting to look at the house. Hey, can we see your house? Can we, you know, we heard from so-and-so. They
the
said,
morbid they come curious.
Here and ask you. So now they've got people showing up all the time and they're like, this is crazy. Why don't we just start charging these people admission? And back then a dime went a lot further than it does today, back in the 1920s, mm-hmm. You know, brother, can you spare a dime? And that was during the Depression. Somebody needed a cup of coffee. So a dime was pretty good money. And so they started putting up, it was Illinois, I'm pretty sure, one of Illinois' very first tourist traps.
Oh, yeah.
And I still, even as a kid, used to see the signs, the billboards that were up. They put these big billboards up that said, Old Slave House, you know, see where slavery existed in Illinois, and it have a picture of the house on it. And they were all up and down Route 1. They were on the side roads coming in, and you couldn't, it was like going out to South Dakota and you couldn't, can't miss the wall drug billboards. It was the same thing with the Old Slave House. It used to be. And so people would start showing up and they were making really good coin doing this. And so whenever people started talking about, you know, ghosts and things upstairs and weird noises they were hearing and rattling chains and all that kind of stuff, that started to spread too. So now you got two different groups of people that you can cash in on. You got mom and dad and the kids on vacation. And then you got people that are like us. They're like, wow, that's a weird spot, man. I got to check it out. Because by the 1920s, you know, most Americans had cars because Model A's and Model T's, you know, relatively speaking, were cheap. And so that was the point. That's why Henry Ford wanted to produce so many of them. That's why he invented the assembly line, mm-hmm. because they wanted to get these cars all over the country so people could get out and get around. So people start going on vacation and they're driving through that area. And that was what really got this place started and put it on the map. And it just started to get more and more attention. And the more ghost stories that were told, the more it started showing up in newspapers and started showing up in magazines. And man, you can track down stories about this place all over the country. And then when the, you know, Associated Press picked up that Hickman Whittington story in the 30s, you know, they were off to the races at that point. It really became a well-known haunted house after that.
Yeah, and with Hickman Whittington, he said, claimed he invented a de-haunting system that used a secret biblical formula for getting rid of spooks and spirits. Why would that be okay, but the shit we, like, that's a spell, an incantation. Well,
but what's
shit,
so
right?
funny about it is when they'd ask him about it, and I couldn't figure out a good way to include this, but I knew we'd talk about it. When they'd ask him about it, so what, how do you use all these Bible verses? Well, I can't tell you, it's secret. I don't want anybody to steal my material. And they said, well, are you a minister or something? He goes, no, I haven't been to church in about 25 years. Not kidding. Oh, so he didn't even go to church, but he just used it. Well, it was kind of like, you know, we talked some about like the hex murders and stuff. We talked mm-hmm. about the hexery and all that stuff in the Pennsylvania Dutch. The same kind of thing. I mean, they all use Bibles. Hoodoo uses Bibles and stuff, but it's not a religious thing. So it's just they think there is a power in the words. And that's essentially what he was doing. It was a little folk magic. Mm-hmm. And he was convinced that his folk magic could get rid of ghosts. Now, I'm not sure what convinced him of this. I'm really not, because he doesn't. The weird thing about it is I can't find anything that says that he ever visited any other haunted house.
Oh, wow.
And that he never visited one before this either. He said he got lots of offers, but the one place he wanted to go, I mean, he just announced this thing. Somebody put it in the paper. And then he announced that, you know, well, yeah, I'm getting lots of offers. People want me to come out, check out their house, but I really just want to go to the Old Slave House because I want to get rid of the ghosts there. And so that's what got people's attention. And so that's why it got printed in paper after paper. And that's why the Associated Press picked it up, because of the Old Slave House. It wasn't anything about his announcement. That just made local news in Benton. That didn't. Mm-hmm. And everybody just figured, oh, he's nuts anyway, you know. But then when it made the Associated Press, then he had to put his money where his mouth is. And he went to the house and they let him wander around, locked himself up in the attic for an hour and, you know, worked on his Bible verses, magic or whatever. And then, well, I think that should do it, you know. And then, no, yeah, it didn't work. But and then, you know, like I said, I really did talk to one of his relatives who told me that story mm-hmm. about him, which is so much. See, there you go. This is a perfect example of I could have just told that story and no one would have ever have known the difference. I had it from a great source or the actual relative of the guy, who should know firsthand that, you know, great uncle Hickman, you know, went home and died in a plate of mashed potatoes. That's a great story, but it's not true.
Yeah.
So I, you know, but I, so I couldn't go back now after, you know, going on and on and on about how we need to know the real story and then tell you what really happened, because it's not hard to find that it wasn't true, because he made the paper a couple more times because he'd already, you know, it already gotten all this press about the house. And then now the next thing they're printing is about how his wife, you know, left him, how his wife divorced him. And that in itself turned out to be kind of interesting, because they'd been married for 36 years and she just had enough. And of course the reporters, you know, were using all kinds of lines, like, you know, the only thing he's chasing now is, you know, that he's hiding from, not hiding from spooks anymore, he's hiding from dishes thrown at him by his wife and stuff like that. And then the next thing you know, he's checked himself into the state hospital in Anna. And he died there, which is not funny. I mean,
I was going to say, damn,
I know it's not funny, but it does kind of put his de-haunting formula in a whole different light, though, you know, knowing that he checked himself into a mental hospital that even he started to think he was nuts. So, you know,
gosh, well, I was going to ask, did he see ghosts because he was insane, or did the ghost drive him insane?
But that's hard to say, right? Or did he just, you know, maybe he was insane because he thought he could get rid of them. I'm not sure. I don't know what the right answer to that would be, but that is unfortunately where he ended his Ghostbuster career.
Yeah.
At the state hospital.
So, regarding people trying to stay there, you know, you told the story about the two Marines after Vietnam.
When I was a kid, that was the thing. Everybody talked about that. I hope we have listeners that who grew up, you know, in downstate to, you know, halfway down to Southern Illinois, who remember these stories too, because everybody talked about staying the night at the old slave house. I mean, I was desperate, like 12. I was desperate to spend the night there. And, no way were my parents going to drive me to Equality so I could spend the night at the old slave house. And by the time I was old enough to do it, he wasn't letting anybody do it anymore because some dumbass set the attic on fire, knocked over a kerosene lantern. But yeah, he told and retold that story. He told it to me probably five times about the Marines that ran out of there in the middle of the night. See, they lived downstairs because the house itself, it was like an attached, almost like a separate house/apartment kind of thing attached to the back of the house that was added on later once they turned it into a tourist attraction, because the inside of the house was decorated to look like the era of the mid, you know, 19th century. So they had a place where they lived in the back. And then usually you could find him kind of in the front, right off the front porch. There was kind of an office area there where sometimes he'd have a couple of books or something, you know, there for sale or something. And, photos or postcards and stuff. And then sometimes he'd go here, he'd come over here. I still remember, I don't remember how old I was, but I had to be in my 20s. And he goes, come here. Yeah, that's before I got to know him. He says, I think you're old enough to see this. I said, God, what's that? So he opens up a handkerchief and it was like a torture device they used to like neuter slaves with. And, you know, and it's like, dude, and I don't want to see that. You know, but as I got to know him, he was just an odd duck. You know, I'm a nice guy. He's always super nice to me. I mean, always. He would call me, you know, I was living in Alton. He'd call me and you know, because he was trying to find somebody that would buy the place and stuff. And he'd tell me and fill me in on the latest news and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, who was looking at it now. And I didn't put all that stuff into the story because it's just a side trail we don't need. But there was a country singer for a while that was going to buy it and had moved the house down to his property in Tennessee. But then they decided it should stay where it was built. And all, I mean, it's just, it went on and on and on. And then, you know, people were supposed to be coming to look at it. He'd chase them off with shotguns. And I mean, some really, really interesting stuff. But yeah, it was a cool place, man. It really was. And anyway, I don't know what, you were asking me about the Marines. Yeah. So anyway, he would tell that story all the time. Tell me about all the people that tried to stay there and nobody did. And when that reporter from the TV station in Harrisburg finally did, George said that it had been 150 people who'd tried to spend the night there over the years and had never made it. And crazy. I just kept thinking, I could make it. I could make it. Let me. We're not doing that. Our insurance won't let us do it anymore. So that was what he always told me. And I don't blame him. If somebody set my place on fire, I wouldn't be very happy about it either. So
yeah, hell no. And so you said the state owns it now?
State owns it now. Yeah. They finally, when he closed it in 96, and he closed it because their health was getting bad and he was getting older and, you know, didn't have family to take it over. And they were trying to get people to buy it. Like I said, that country singer and a bunch of other people, but he really wanted the state to buy it because he wanted it to remain how it was and be preserved. And so the state hem-hawed around and danced around. I mean, it's Illinois, you know how that goes, and danced around it. And, you know, oh, we're going to need some verification. Dude, again, circumstantial evidence, all we got, you know, but they're going to need this. And finally, in 99, they bought it. And they were supposed to reopen it, I don't know how many times, and they just never have. It's still sitting empty. So I don't know if it'll ever reopen, but you can't go there. There are cameras and there's security on site. They've got somebody who lives in that, in George and Janice's old house there in the back. And I have turned into the driveway and had vehicles down to stop me. You can't even drive up because the driveway turns off Route 1 and then there's a long drive and then you go up the hill to the hilltop. You can see the house from the highway, but you can't get any closer than that. You can't. If you get any closer, they will come after you and you will be arrested. Hey, so
they're spending resources on this thing.
I know. I don't even know. I have no idea if they're preserving it or not. Because I mean, you know, winters could be really tough on that place because there's nothing around it. It is just up on a hill. And so, I mean, it gets all the wind, it gets all the weather. So I don't know if they're preserving it or not. I mean, and it had a lot of antiques and stuff in it, including some original stuff from the house when the Crenshaws still lived there. So I don't know if any of that stuff has been preserved. You know, I thought that maybe the state would get jazzed over it because, you know, the rumor was that Abraham Lincoln had slept there. But honestly, I don't think he did. I think that was just a story. He was in Equality or in the town at one time, back when the Crenshaws still owned it. He was there for some kind of like a barbecue or something for the Whig party, you know, pre-Republican party that Lincoln, you know, but Crenshaw was like the head of the Democrat party in town back when they were vice versa what they are now, and he was a Democrat, so the chances of him actually coming and staying there seem unlikely. So because they couldn't prove that, you know, people have kind of hemmed and hawed about the whole slavery angle too, but I think that's pretty well, there are a lot of historians down there, some who poo-poo the whole thing, but there are some really solid guys down there who have been working on it for years and years, and they're convinced that it's legit. I would agree. I'm not an expert. I'm not the expert they are for sure. And, but I think there's enough evidence that exists to say that these stories were real. And based on all of that, the ghost stories, you know, ghost stories don't just stick around for no reason at all. If there hadn't been, and listen, anytime it ever comes up, especially if I'm down in that area or I'm talking to somebody who's older, who grew up in the southern half of the state, they all have old slave house stories. And they'll all talk about, oh yeah, I went there. That's the creepiest place. I mean, they'll all talk about it. So it's one of those things that is kind of forgotten these days. It's kind of like, you know, reruns of Hogan's Heroes or something. They mean a lot to me, but other people are like, yeah, whatever. I'm going to watch a, you know, comedy about a POW camp, but it's the same kind of thing. People are like, slave house, do what? But the people my age and older for sure all remember the place. So I had to include it in the episode. If nothing else, maybe we'll introduce it to a younger breed of people. And maybe there'll be somebody listening who can do something about, you know, getting this place open again. It would be nice. That's for sure. So.
Yeah. And I also hope that we introduce younger people to Hogan's Heroes, because it's hilarious.
It's really funny. and the extracurricular activities of Bob Crane, which we covered in a bonus episode, I believe. I don't think that was on the main line, was it? Yes.
I can't remember.
I don't remember where we put that.
But, it was the Hollywood season.
Yeah, it was the Hollywood season for sure. And you were like, what? Yeah, you didn't know this? No. Yeah.
I had heard it referenced on Family Guy. And
oh, that's right. That's right. We did talk about that.
Well, that was all I had for that.
Great.
Is there anything that I missed?
Yeah, no, I hope you liked it. I hope you like these, because I know that a lot of these so far are ones you haven't been very familiar with. And I've been trying to do things that aren't, I mean, yeah, we started out with the Myrtles, but I'm trying to do some stuff. Like our next episode will be, believe it or not, an Easter themed episode.
Ooh.
About a family massacre.
Yes.
And it's on the haunted house. So I'm trying to do stuff that is not like, you know, stuff everybody knows, you know. So
beautiful.
Anyway,
I love it.
Cool.
Well, it is now time for our Ghostwriter segment. So if you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. This comes to us from Amanda. And this is appropriate from what you were talking about earlier. It's titled Bonnie and Clyde. Said, have you ever thought to maybe do a series on their crimes and execution? Well, you're doing it.
Well, dinner, as a matter of fact, my last book that I did, the one Until Death Do Us Part, the whole first section is Bonnie and Clyde. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually doing a Bonnie and Clyde dinner on March 16th. Yeah. So,
that'll be fun. Check those out if you can.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, that's all I got, man.
All right. Cool. So, well, guys, thanks for listening. We hope that you will share the show with your friends, your neighbors, anyone you know. If you like the show, or even if you don't, leave us a 5-star review anyway. Or if you leave us a 1-star review, please make it funny and not lame. So, or you can send us an email, or you can drop us a text on the haunt line at 217-791-7859. I can't remember if I read that earlier.
Did I?
Okay, good. Couldn't remember. So anyway, you can reach out to us there. You can also check us out on social media. You can find Cody and I on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. TikTok. I just bothered lately. No, I just haven't been able to keep up with it. So supposed to be working on some other videos at some point here, and I just have been too busy. So we'll see what happens. So anyway, don't forget to use the discount code podcast when you're shopping for books, tours, events, whatever, at AmericanHauntings.net. You'll also find the link there for Cody's shirt store, which is AmericanHauntingsClothing.com. And you can use that same code there too. And you'll always get, by using the podcast code, you'll always get 10% off everything you order. And I just put up a website today for the new museum. So I just, because it's done, I just want to say it is AmericanOddities Museum.com. So check it out.
Beautiful.
It's like one page, but it is all the information on it that you could possibly need. So, all right. Well, guys, thank you so much. And we will talk to you again in 2 weeks.
Unless
you're on Patreon, then it's only 1 week. So
yes, of course. Did you see the person on Twitter that said they were all caught up?
Yes.
For listening for the third time.
Yeah. And I thought, God, that is torture. I mean, that is what you do to people to try to get information out of them.
Exactly.
So, you know, here, we're going to make you listen to the American Hauntings podcast over and over again. You will tell us everything you know. And I give it up in like 5 minutes. So,
yeah. We licensed it to
just have to listen to my own voice. You know, I would just give everything up.
This episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and performed by Troy Taylor, and it was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, which features show notes, links, and photographs that go along with the episode.
Well, yeah, we have kind of fallen behind on the photographs, and
that's my fault.
No, it's actually my fault, because I was thinking with the missing people, it seemed imperative. And then it hasn't seemed that way for this one, because the houses are pretty easy to find. But what do you think? Do you need me to send you some stuff or not? Or should we
maybe we should catch
up later? Okay.
Yeah, let's catch up later.
All right.
But
just let me know. I need a breath here. to keep you catching up on things. But I'll see what I can do about getting you some stuff over for that.
Okay.
Because it did dawn on me when I saw that in there, and I thought, I've gotten behind on that.
Well, so. It's enough to get episodes out. After that, we're just kind of
you're right. It kind of lately has been that way. Yes. So.
Matt, thanks again for listening. We definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later. All right. That was good.
That was a long one. Sorry, man.
Yeah, no.